front of the building was like riddled with bullet holes where cars used to drive up and down and spray the place.
Sam, you also served in Tyrone. Are there any, was it very different serving along the border, and are there any particular stories or reminiscences that you have from that time?
Yeah, well, rural areas are very different from urban ones. In Tyrone, as a sergeant in the mobile support unit, so though we backed up the local police in Dungannon, we also could be all over the place. Like, we went up to Belfast, up at Ainsworth Avenue, the time the UVF guy blew himself up at Amapreator. But Dungannon changed me. At 1 week, whereas within about 25 feet of three bombs inside a week, none of which went off properly. I remember thinking, I can't do this anymore, I need to get out of this, because it wasn't too long after two friends that Colleen McMurray used to work with in Armagh, she had been killed in Newry, and another guy probably nobody's ever heard of, a guy called Billy Evans, he ironically was killed by the army, out the foot patrol up near New Barnsley, and an army Land Rover ran over and killed him. I remember speaking to him a few months before, saying, get out of there. I don't believe in much, but I believe in the law of averages, and if you push your luck too long, sooner or later something's going to happen to you. So I think the deaths of those two were preying on my mind, and I thought, I need to get a job in headquarters or something, you know, because I'd gone through all these years of sort of near misses and something happening to somebody changed the shift with me and seeing things happen to other people. And I thought, it's only a matter of time before it happens to me. So applied for job and training and got that.
We crossed our own paths, me and yourself, through a reconciliation, an informal, let's say, reconciliation programme.
Yeah.
How has it been for you on that kind of journey in reconciliation?
It hasn't made a profound difference. You know, I think as you get older, you start to reflect on life. And there's an old saying, if you think the same at 40 as you did in 20, you've wasted 20 years. And I started this interview by saying I basically come from a couple hundred yards away. And the thought occurred to me one day, the idea that someone should be an eternal enemy because they happen to be born 200 yards away from you or born on the other side of a street from you is absolutely absurd. It's absurd. But that's the situation that we find ourselves in here. So I thought of that, and again, occasionally you see these little inspirational quotes, which may or may not be true. There's one supposed to be from Martin Luther King, said that hating someone is like drinking poison and hoping they'll die. Look, I could hit Michelle all I want. You're probably not even going to know, but it's not going to affect your life, but it'll affect mine. And is it going to make me any happier? No. Will it bring anyone back? No. Is it going to make the future any better for people that are children now or unborn? No. So some people, that's their way to get through life, is carrying grudges and resentments and hate. I just think it doesn't do any good, and it wasn't making me feel any better. You know, I, by and large, don't suffer from PTSD or anything like that anymore, and I think this has helped because, in my mind, the war is over. There's other people can't accept that it's over for many, many reasons, some entirely legitimate. They've suffered a lot worse than I have. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the right thing to do. It's not going to change the world, but I think it's up to each and every individual to do their own little bit.
I agree with you, Sam. I think hate is a very negative emotion and very wasteful. And, you know, we all have to move on. So where do you stand on the reunification question? Have you thought about our future politically?
These days I'm pretty agnostic on it. I was always, I suppose, a small U unionist. I wasn't a diehard. Like, I agreed with a statement I heard quite early in my time in the police, where somebody says to me, I'm not too bothered about a United Ireland. What I am bothered about is somebody trying to bomb me into it. Any sort of affection I had for the union died on the morning of the Brexit referendum. That to me is a watershed moment. Because that to me showed it doesn't matter what we think here, you know, it's what England wants, really. I know people say it's a UK-wide referendum, but there's no way that Scotland and Northern Ireland should have been forced out against this will. Scotland in particular is like a distinct country and all the rest of it. And I also just think it's incredibly stupid. I think that the UK basically, that they decided to commit suicide. And I'm convinced of that. I think that historians look back, that is the day when the Union was fatally wounded, and it was a self-inflicted wound.
And on that, what would you like to see from Republicans to go that extra bit that would maybe convince you that reunification would be an option?
I think I see a bit of schizophrenia from Republicanism. On the one hand, there's this outreach, we want peace. But on the other, there's this sort of like constant propaganda war, which is still being waged, and quite a bit of hostility, continually refighting the troubles. And at some stage, this is going to have to stop. You know, unionists who had relations in the police or UDR aren't going to look upon their relatives as evil child killers any more than relatives. The IRA men are going to regard their relatives in that. And all it's doing is winding people up and giving people an excuse not to talk to them. I think as a society, and I'm not just pointing the finger at Republicans here, it's all over. We need to stop absolutely wallowing in the past. We're not remembering it, we're wallowing in it. You know, I did an article once that Japan recovered from two atom bombs quicker than Northern Ireland's recovered from the Troubles. 15 years after Hiroshima, they were hosting the Olympics and are one of the best economies in the world, because they just decided that we're not going to talk about all this, we're just going to move on, make a better country.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside historian and former RUC man, Sam Thompson.
All right. So, close to where you were born and brought up,
yep.
Sam, there's a massive community festival,
yeah,
called Feeling Bubble, and that came out of commemorating the, or remembering internment,
yep,
and then it became a community,
yep,
festival as a more positive way of remembering the past. So, you know, do you think that something like that could be replicated? I know it looks at and speaks to people from all political persuasions and none, and it's just such an inclusive festival. Do you know, attended any events? Or?
Oh, I have indeed. I've attended events in the past, and I think it's a very positive thing, because, as I said, I arrived in Springfield Road 40 years ago, and I remember those annual internment things, and it was sort of like that film The Purge. You know, the civilians sort of took it upon the night, anything goes, from both them and the police. Like, there was batting rounds fired in, and they could be written off in a form, which any other time of the year would be, what did you do that for? But those internment nights, it was like ritualistic rioting. And you had people hurt, and you had people occasionally getting killed. So I think that's I'll give credit where it's due. That's marvellous credit, primarily to Sinn Féin, for turning that round, to have a very destructive time into something more positive. Some of the events are more cross-community than others, but that's okay. You know, if I don't want to go to something, I won't. You know, it's like the annual Bobby Sands March, you know, in May or whatever. It doesn't bother me, because I don't have to go anywhere near it. So, yeah, that's good, and I would like to see that being extended across the Shankill and East Belfast, and maybe have a whole summer of cultural events. But, you know, I think those events are worthwhile, because you've now got, you know, unionists going to them, and one of the commentators is going along, and it's letting also people in West Belfast speak directly to people that they wouldn't normally speak to. So I think it's all generally quite positive. I know there's a bit of controversy about one or two things, but by and large, I approve of it.
This week, we take a look at the history of partition. How was Ireland divided, and what has that meant for the population of the North over this last 100 years?
The official partitioning of Ireland took place in May 1921 via an act passed by the British Parliament. The original intention was for both regions to remain within the United Kingdom, but the Irish War of Independence led to the South seceding from the UK in 1922. Attempts at legislating the Government of Ireland Act first began in 1886. The Government of Ireland Act of 1920 was the fourth try at establishing Home Rule in Ireland. That is, affording the country a certain amount of freedom to self-govern while retaining its position as part of the United Kingdom. Up to that point, Ireland had been ruled by the UK Parliament via their administration at Dublin Castle, ever since the Irish Parliament was abolished through the Acts of Union 1800. After many attempts at negotiating the division of the 9 northerly counties of Ulster from the 23 remaining counties that comprise Munster, Leinster and Connacht, only 6 counties within Ulster were included in the 4th Irish Home Rule Bill of 1920. This was to ensure a Protestant majority for many years to come. After the 3rd Home Rule Bill was passed in 1912, Ulster Unionists had founded a paramilitary force named the Ulster Volunteer Force, with the intention of resisting the bill's implementation by violent means. Many British Army officers stationed in Ireland resigned, and with nationalists having established their own military army in response, with both sides importing arms, a civil war seemed imminent. Eventually, a trial period of partition was also included in the third version of the Irish Home Rule Bill to appease unionists, but when World War I broke out in 1914, the bill was suspended. In an attempt to take advantage of Britain's distraction with the war, an insurrection was launched by Irish revolutionaries on Easter 1916. Following this rebellion, more attempts were made to reach a compromise, such as the 1917-18 Irish Convention in Dublin, with little success. In 1919, the Irish War of Independence officially began. The Government of Ireland Act was enacted in 1920, and the island was partitioned the following year. Home Rule never came into effect in the South. Instead, the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921, which ended the war in Ireland, allowed the self-governing Irish Free State to be created, and thus the partitioning of Ireland became official.
And that does it for another week. I'd like to thank our special guest, Sam Thompson, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of iNews has covered this story and tells us more. UK councils warned free school meals during holidays will likely be withdrawn for hundreds of thousands of school pupils after Easter due to the end of government funding. Local authorities and charities are urging the government to extend its Household Support Fund scheme, which was first introduced in autumn of 2021 and distributed among local councils to help those in need during the cost of living crisis. Originally set to last until spring of 2022, the scheme had been extended three times, taking the total amount of funding to £2.5 billion, while England was given a further £842 million in April of 2023 in order to support those in need. However, the fund was not mentioned in the autumn statement by the Chancellor and is now due to come to an end on 31st of March. The scheme has been used by local councils to fund free school meal vouchers during the holidays, which has become a lifeline for low-income families during and since the pandemic, and takes up much of the money local authorities receive through the scheme. Beverly Craig, leader of Manchester City Council, said it is heartbreaking to think that her local authority will no longer be able to fund free school meal vouchers and other cost of living support when the fund comes to an end. She said, "We're a city that has historic levels of poverty and deprivation, often overlooked. Over 43% of our kids are growing up in poverty. Council analysis has shown that 20% of Manchester residents have a disposable income of less than £30 a month after rent, food and bills." Beverly Craig said, "Last year alone, the city spent over £50 million alleviating poverty and dealing with the cost of living crisis," adding that the council has been assisted this year by a Household Support Fund grant of £12.9 million. Councillor Craig said that this has enabled the council to help 60,000 people, including 40,000 children, receiving free school meal vouchers outside of term time, 12,500 vulnerable households getting cost of living support payments, 6,000 children benefiting from a holiday activity fund, and 400 care leavers accessing a boost to their income. Beverly Craig said, "So for a city like us, losing out on the Household Support Fund, it really is a problem. There's 60,000 people that we're able to support in addition to all of the work that we're doing around poverty stops overnight." She added, "We're seeing vulnerable families who had a little bit of money tucked away for a rainy day have spent the rainy day money." Manchester City Council is calling for a year-long extension to the Household Support Fund, considering that economic forecasts suggest that the situation may have improved slightly by this time next year. But obviously, there's a longer-term discussion that this should be mainstreamed into budgets. Bella Sankey, the leader of Brighton and Hove City Council, which together with councils in Plymouth, Lambeth, Bristol and Southampton, has written to the government to stress the importance of the Household Support Fund, said that she has been horrified by what she has seen and heard in local food banks. She said, "Demand is now out of control, completely outstripping supply, like nothing that has ever been experienced before. The amount of discretionary food vouchers we would previously give out over the course of a year during COVID now goes out the door in just 1 month." She added, "The concern is that people are clearly going without food," adding that the situation could potentially be having an impact on school attendance, as she has heard from one parent who was terrified about their child going to secondary school and needing to find the money to pay their bus fare. She said, "Those are the sorts of calculations and decisions people are having to make." Graham Witham, the Chief Executive Officer of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, said that the Household Support Fund has been really important, adding that the Free School Meals Council have been able to provide during holidays has helped build a safety net for families. Graham Witham said, "The other side of it is that councils themselves are cash-strapped and don't have a significant ring-fence funding for welfare provision. So this has just been massive. It's enabled councils to stand up to responses to need that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And it's created some space for innovation as well." He said he believes that historically, government has washed its hand of local welfare provision, but that the Household Support Fund helped it to understand the value of the role that local authorities have. Graham Witham, the CEO of Greater Manchester Poverty Action, sees the end of the funding as a big cliff edge because cost of living support payment from the government ends in March as well. He called for permanent ring-fence funding for local welfare provision by local councils. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Lynn Perry, the chief executive of the British charity Barnardo's, said, "Across the United Kingdom, families are struggling to pay their bills or feed their children, often borrowing money and taking on debt just to get through another week. It's vital that the Household Support Fund continues." Lynn Perry added, "The fund ends in March of 2024, so time is running out. Without renewal, it will leave a major hole in local crisis support." Leeds City Council Executive Member for Communities, Mary Harland, said the situation is looking pretty grim without the Household Support Fund, adding that, despite being an economically vibrant city, we do still have something like 22% of our population living in poverty, including 35,000 individuals or one in five children. She said, "The Household Support Fund has helped Leeds City boost what it offers through its welfare support scheme, which provides food and fuel vouchers, white goods and help with building maintenance," adding that it is a vital scheme. Gespil, an organisation which works with vulnerable young people across the city, told the local council that it had been able to top up the gas meter of a family living in one of the most deprived areas of the city of Leeds, who had not had heating for several weeks and whose children had been off school with colds and other illnesses. A report published recently by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation found that informal carers are 8% more likely to be living in poverty than those with no caring responsibilities, at 28% compared to 20%. Dominic Carter, Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Carter's Trust, said, "We need to think about what the Household Support Fund being taken away might mean for people like that. What else will they have to go without? We know that for a large number of unpaid carers, they put family members first, often to the detriment of their own health and their own well-being." It comes as council leaders have also called for reform of local government finance and an end to short-term measures after Community Secretary Michael Gove confirmed authorities will receive £500 million in emergency funding for social care.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Since mid-November 2023, the Yemen-based Ansarullah movement has attacked dozens of commercial ships destined to the occupied territories. The ships were mostly attacked in the Red Sea. Yemeni officials say the attacks are a show of support for the Palestinian people in Gaza. The attacks have practically halted commercial activities in the port of Eilat in the occupied territories. They've also increased global commercial costs. The U.S. and U.K. have militarized the region with their strikes on Yemen. An exodus of shipping companies from the region now threatens to scuttle supply chains and increase consumer prices. More than 150 commercial ships have chosen the longer route since November. The Red Sea is one of the most important arteries in the global shipping system, with one-third of all container traffic flowing through it. Any sustained disruption in trade there could send a ripple effect of higher costs throughout the world economy. This is particularly true of energy. 12% of seaborne oil and 8% of liquefied natural gas, LNG, transits the Suez Canal. Ships shunning the Red Sea will have to instead sail around the Horn of Africa, which can cost $1 million more round trip and additional fuel costs.
Gaza, where Israel's air and artillery strikes have become a regular occurrence. In the besieged strip, sounds of bombardment are followed by screams of mothers losing their kids, as well as cries of children whose parents are killed by the regime. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, most of them women and kids, have been killed in the relentless strikes since October 7th. Humanitarian organizations report that more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs per day in the coastal territory. And that's just one aspect of the unending cycle of Israel's brutality against the people of Gaza. Apart from casualties, the regime's recurring attacks have caused indescribable devastation in the Palestinian territory. But when it comes to describing the true nature of the Israeli onslaught, there's no word better than genocide. There are multiple reports and countless evidence indicating that what's taking place in Gaza meets the definition of a genocidal war. Since the very beginning of the onslaught, millions of people around the world, along with a number of states, have been calling on international institutions to oblige Israel to end the genocide. South Africa is one of those states. The country, in late December, filed a lawsuit against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now, nearly 1 month after the lawsuit was filed, the Hague-based court is set to convene on Friday to decide on South Africa's request for an interim ruling in its genocide case against Israel. The possible verdict by the ICJ would order Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the Palestinian territory. In its filing, Pretoria referred to Israel's violation of the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa's application includes multiple offenses, from indiscriminate killing of Palestinians to the wholesale destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Earlier in January, the Hague-based court convened two-day hearings. At the closing of the first day, the South African ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its onslaught on the besieged strip.
One, the state of Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza. Two, the state of Israel shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed, supported, or influenced by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control, direction, or influence, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above.
South Africa's move has been welcomed by Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas said the arguments and evidence put forth by South Africa proves Israel's crimes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also applauded the move, calling it a historic moment for humanity.
This is a historical moment for the Palestinian people and for humanity, as well as for the world order based on law.
A number of countries and international organizations have welcomed South Africa's case at the ICJ. The Organization of Islamic Countries, OIC, and the Arab League expressed their support for the case. Malaysia, Turkey, Jordan, and Iran are among the states voicing support for the motion. Israel's crimes against Palestinians in in Gaza have also been referred to the International Criminal Court. Mexico and Chile have requested the ICC to probe the crimes against civilians in Gaza. Submitting lawsuits at international courts are parts of global efforts to mandate Israel to put an end to its non-stop strikes on Gaza, as their scale and nature dovetail with the widely accepted narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war.
South Africa has taken the step to invoke the Genocide Convention and charge Israel in the International Court of Justice. While there are severe limitations to this process, it is undeniably momentous to see Israel brought before the highest international court to answer for its crime of genocide against the Palestinians. The relationship between South Africa and Palestine is deep and cannot be underestimated. It was forged through oppression and racial subjugation. Israel was a key player in the development and later the malignancy of apartheid rule in South Africa. South Africa's apartheid prime minister, Daniel Malan, was the first foreign prime minister to visit Tel Aviv following the Nakba. Hendrik Verwoerd, a South African apartheid architect and prime minister, even claimed in 1961 that Israel, like South Africa, is an apartheid state. That was six decades before Amnesty International said the same. In order to improve the image of apartheid in South Africa, Israel and the apartheid authorities established a joint secretariat for political and psychological warfare in 1975. By 1981, the apartheid army in South Africa had 200 Israeli military advisors, and hundreds of apartheid troops were also educated in Israeli military academies. Israeli military instructors provided direct guidance to the South African Reconnaissance Commando's elite unit in particular. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, played a key role in the development of South Africa's military electronics industry. South Africa's naval forces were also trained in Israel and sold radar systems by ELTA, a subsidiary of the state-owned Israeli Aerospace Industries. Israel was also essential to the construction of an electric wall to police the border of apartheid South Africa, with a crew of 50 Israeli technicians stationed permanently at the wall for maintenance. The Israelis also planted radar devices and minefields along the border. Israeli intelligence agencies had a steady presence in apartheid-era South Africa. The apartheid intelligence agency BOS ran a letter bomb campaign against ANC figures like Ruth First, which employed similar methods in its Operation Wrath of God against Palestinians in Lebanon. It is thought likely that Israel provided support for this. The Israel spy agency, the ADL, also spied on many anti-apartheid activists, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and sold the information to BOS agents of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Israel and apartheid South Africa worked closely on nuclear research, with South African uranium proving extremely useful to Israel's covert nuclear program. Are we witnessing the revenge of history?
Over 100 days into the U.S.-Israeli war on Gaza, over 100 days of death and destruction for a regime which indiscriminately targets any moving thing anywhere in the war-ridden strip, be it residential buildings, medics, journalists, hospitals, or schools, an all-out war against the Palestinian territory from air, sea, and land, killing over 25,000 people, most of them innocent women and children. The Israeli aggression has been repeatedly described as not just a war, but a genocide and an attempt at the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. The bloodthirsty regime, however, has failed to reach any of the goals it has stated to justify its ongoing bloodshed, annihilating Hamas, setting free scores of captives held in Gaza, and pushing Palestinians out of their ancestral lands. On the ground, Palestinian fighters have inflicted heavy losses, both on the regime's military hardware and on IOF troopers. Back in the occupied territories, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing growing domestic outrage over his failure in the war and in securing the release of nearly 130 captives held by Hamas, both from ordinary people.
On the morning of October 7th, this government and this Prime Minister totally failed us. After 107 days, we are demanding that they fix the failure.
And a widening rift within Israel's political and military establishment. Israeli cabinet minister and former military chief Gadi Eisenkot is only one of the Israeli officials that have recently dismissed any achievement in Gaza. Eisenkot says the military operation in Gaza has failed to bring the captives back, arguing that the only solution is a deal with Hamas.
That it's impossible in the near future to restore the hostages alive without a deal.
Eisenkot's words contradicts a previous statement by Benjamin Netanyahu that rejects conditions presented by Hamas to end the war and release captives that would include Israel's complete withdrawal and leaving Hamas in power in Gaza. Meanwhile, growing protests have been held on a weekly basis in Israel, calling on the regime to take action to secure the release of their loved ones. Such demands, however, have fallen on deaf ears. With the war in its fourth month now, public opinion has shifted further against Netanyahu, leading to louder calls for leadership changes and the possibility of an early election. In the coming days, a Knesset meeting will be held to discuss a no-confidence motion against the premier. The motion, submitted by the opposition Labour Party, accuses Netanyahu of failing to make necessary decisions to get the captives freed. As protests reverberate through a cabinet already rattled by massive demonstrations in 2023, the question looms: will Netanyahu heed the voices of the people, or will he prioritize his own political pursuit over their demands? Perhaps it will take a new election for the Israelis to make their voices heard, an early election that would topple the hard-right premier after over 16 years in office.
The United States has launched a new wave of attacks in Yemen. The fresh missile salvo was fired from U.S. Navy ships stationed in the Red Sea and targeted sites that were allegedly prepared to launch attacks. Over a dozen locations were said to have been hit in the strikes. The Yemeni Sabah News Agency reported that the aerial assault hit the provinces of Hodeidah, Taiz, Damar, Al-Baida, and Sada. The aggression was accompanied by the presence of surveillance aircraft over the western part of Yemen.
This aggression will not change anything in the stance of our people and its spiritual obligation in supporting the Palestinian people and the residents of Gaza, as well as the continuous targeting of ships linked to Israel. And this is clear in our continuous operations.
Yemeni armed forces have said that they will not hesitate to target all sources of threat in the Arabian and Red Seas within the country's legitimate right of self-defense. They've also warned that any aggression against Yemen by the U.S. or the U.K. will not go unanswered and unpunished. The Washington designated Ansarullah Movement as a terrorist organization. The Ansarullah Resistance Movement has described the U.S. move to redesignate the movement as a terrorist organization as, quote, a badge of honor.
Designation of the United States here in Yemen, they don't care about that, but they are honored to have that relisting as a terrorist organization because we know, and as Sayyid Abdul Malik have said, United States is just the face of the crime. United States is one of the countries that have destroyed, have destruction wherever they go. So we are honored to be designated as terrorist because, as always they say, one man terrorist is another man freedom fighter.
Ansarullah spokesman Mohammed Abdul Salam added that the move also proves the impact of Yemen's anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea. As part of their support for Palestinians, the Yemeni armed forces and Ansarullah popular resistance movement have, over the past month, targeted several ships owned by the Israeli regime or bound for ports in the occupied territories in the strategic Red Sea after multiple warnings. earlier in January, the U.S., along with the U.K., attacked Yemen in a theatrical show of support for the Israeli regime.
The issue that America and Britain have joined the war directly and that we are now in direct confrontation with the Americans, British and Israelis does not scare us at all. The aggression towards our country and our people will enhance the development of our military capabilities.
This was a brutal aggression, a violation of our sovereignty. I mean, after 10 years of war on the Yemeni people, a siege on land, air and sea, and to add to that, they are targeting us with a new aggression. This is a new stage of the conflict. What does this reflect? It reflects a violation of sovereignty, further injustice towards people.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups. neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddie was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Keddie highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American university lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. ¶¶ In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Halliday. John Foran from the University of California in Santa Barbara focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran, as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Halliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development, like others too. He too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Halliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Halliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda selfies. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. So what I want to say is that with regard to spiritual journeying, spiritual ascension, and true human values, gender is not important at all, except in certain cases where one gender is preferred over the other, and that is a preference for women over men, as far as I have seen, and I have not seen anything besides this. These are the places where a person's gender does not matter. It is the same with regard to the principle of social responsibilities. Imam Khomeini said somewhere that it is a woman's duty to be involved in politics and to address the fundamental issues of the country. They have a right and a duty to be involved. so he made it obligatory for women to actively participate in shaping the country's destiny and to address the country's fundamental issues. And this itself has a long chapter continuing in it, meaning there is no difference between men and women in these areas.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Regarding being involved in the affairs of the society, it is said, whoever wakes up in the morning without caring about the affairs of the Muslim community is not a Muslim. Is not a Muslim addresses both men and women. When you wake up in the morning, whether you are a housewife, an office worker, an employee, or a craftswoman, whatever it is that you do, you must have the society in mind. You should care about the state of the society. Now, how much you can help and play a role may vary. Each person can play a role, and this effort is required for everyone. This action, effort, and caring is required for everyone. Gender does not matter here either. Another example may be seen in the hadith, whoever hears someone cry out, "O Muslims," the woman who just spoke here said, "The way is closed regarding the matter of Palestine and Gaza. Otherwise, we would have gone if we could have." For example, imagine this woman, who is a doctor, could have gone there and attended to the sick, the injured, the woman, and the children. Everyone has their own role to play. But the important thing is that everyone must make an effort, has a duty, and should have a sense of responsibility regardless of whether they are male or female.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Only minutes before dawn on Sunday, January 28th, a roaring sound broke the silence of Iran's central desert. The Seymour satellite launch vehicle was successfully sent into space from Imam Khomeini Space Launch Terminal in Semnan Province with an unprecedented mission. To put three homegrown satellites into orbit with a minimum altitude of 450 kilometers and a maximum of 1,100 kilometers above the Earth's surface. The successful launch, marked by multiple injection of satellites into orbit, has ushered in a new era in the country's space program.
For the first time in the history of the country's space program, we managed to inject multiple satellites into space.